Somewhat belatedly, we're going to open the meeting of the House Committee on Land Use for Tuesday, March 24th, 2009, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2227. Looks like we've got three amendments that might be discussed before the committee. One set of those amendments is still being copied, so I'll make available comments about the first two if anyone would like to. Did you want to speak to those amendments, Representative?
Madam Chair, is it your intention to move the bill today?
I think I want to give the committee an opportunity to absorb the amendments that are proposed, so probably not move the bill today. This will likely be the last public hearing on the bill, though, since we do have new amendments, and I want to give the public an opportunity to weigh in on those. But I would expect that we would have a work session to move the bill on Thursday. But I'd like the public and the committee to have the benefit of hearing potential amendments if we can today.
Okay. Well, the Dash 1 amendment addresses the Measure 49 rights component of the bill. There was a great deal of support for Measure 49 in the last legislature, and the idea that I think is a constitutional concept, that when a person owns a piece of property and the government changes the rules and devalues their land, that they have a right of action. They have a right to some compensation for the takings that ensues. And as currently written, House Bill 2227 would remove that right for some people. And so what my amendment does is simply take that section out and make sure that the rules of Measure 49 continue to apply.
Okay. Let's see if any committee members have questions about that amendment. Representative Cowan?
Just for clarification, thank you. Because I don't have the ORSs in front of me, so by removing Section 7 on page 6, that ORS reference, that's what it accomplishes. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Representative Winger?
Representative Cowan, I can tell you that my request to LC was to remove the section that seemed to interfere with a person's Measure 49 rights, and that this Dash 1 was what they returned to me. So without being a lawyer, I believe that the answer to your question is yes.
So it deletes that section and renumbers the subsequent section.
Well, I understand that. I was just trying to get if that's what that ORS reference was. Okay.
Okay.
That's my reading, too.
He is a lawyer.
And I am a lawyer.
And he is a lawyer, yes. Okay. Thank you.
I don't even play one on TV.
Dash one.
And
yeah.
I don't try to either.
Right.
By taking out this language.
Okay.
This deletes everything through page 7.
No.
You're looking at the dash one.
Dash one?
Oh, the dash one. The other one does that.
We haven't gotten there yet, Representative.
No, I'm looking at
the dash one amendments have on page 1, delete all these things.
You're looking at the dash 3.
I'm at the 3s. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm back in the game.
And what I'm going to do is have an opportunity to basically introduce three amendments, and then we'll open it up for public discussion on all three amendments. Did you want to talk about the dash 3s? Are those yours, too?
If you'd like. And I'm
Representative?
We can talk about them at length if you'd like, but in short, I feel that the bill moves too quickly on this issue, and that what we really ought to be doing is asking LCDC to reevaluate the process of destination resorts and to study it and to report back to us. So that is essentially what the Dash 3 amendments do, is to not rush this process, but instead to ask for a real evaluation of this rather than moving ahead with a bill that I think has some consequences in it that the committee hasn't fully thought through.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you. I would like to invite Mr. Whitman to come and describe the Dash 5 amendment that has just been distributed. Mr. Whitman. This is an amendment that has had a number of interested parties participate and contribute to some amendments, some changes, some compromises with the underlying bill, and represents a lot of considered thought. But, Mr. Whitman, I think you'll be in a better position to walk us through what this amendment would do with the underlying bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Richard Whitman, the Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I am going to walk you through the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2227. I have to apologize that we don't have a hand-engrossed version of the bill, so bear with me as I walk you through these Dash 5 amendments. And so I'm going to be doing this using the Dash 5 amendments as well as the underlying bill, House Bill 2227. So the first change under the Dash 5s is on page 2 of the bill to delete lines 22 through 45. And what that accomplishes, that along with the second change on page 3, is to delete the Section 2 in House Bill 2227 as introduced, and then it is replaced with this new Section 2 that you see in your Dash 5 amendments. The basic changes between what you have in the bill as introduced and what is in the Dash 5 amendments, there are two changes in Section 2. The first is that we are changing, would propose to change the mandatory shall in line 22 of the introduced bill to a permissive may. So this is now becoming authorization to the Land Conservation and Development Commission to undertake this review and updating of our destination resort program under statewide land use planning goal 8. Rather than the mandatory shall. The reason for that is, frankly, in recognition of the current fiscal situation in the state. This still provides the authorization to LCDC, but does not require that it be done right away. The second change in Section 2 between the bill as introduced and the Dash 5 amendments is the deletion of a number of paragraphs in that Section 2 that were felt by the group that was working on this to not be necessary to call out in the legislation to essentially focus the study and the analysis of the department and the commission on the other provisions in Section 2. And those were paragraphs F through I of Section 2 sub 1. So that, Madam Chair, takes us to line 23 of page 2 of the Dash 5 amendments.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat which those were?
Those, Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick, those were paragraphs, try to get this right, paragraphs F through I.
In Section 2B?
2 sub 1. I'm sorry, I misspoke, 2 sub 2. Questions about that? Okay. The next change appears on page 2 of the Dash 5 amendments, starting on line 23. We have a deletion that then continues on to page 6. What that is a deletion of the introduced Section 7 of House Bill 2227. And that is, it's the deletion of Sections 5, 6, and 7 of introduced 2227. And then we have it replaced with a new Section 5 and a new Section 6, as shown here in the Dash 5 amendments. Before I run through Section 5 and Section 6, I just want to make clear that means the deletion of Section 7, which is the same as I understand it, although I've not seen it, the proposal in the Dash 1 amendments to eliminate the provision of the bill addressing Measure 49. Okay.
Not deletion of that section, which I believe is what Representative Wingert was trying to accomplish in the Dash 1 and is also incorporated in the Dash 5.
That's correct,
Madam
Chair.
Leaves this bill silent on that. It doesn't give any special credits. It doesn't take anything away. It just says Measure 49 stands on its own. I think the effect of both of those would be the same.
That's correct, Madam Chair. So Section 5, starting on line 25, page 2 of the Dash 5 amendments. Let me just work through this. And again, this reflects work of a informal work group on this. It provides that with regard to mapping, that a county, so Section 5 is the part of the destination resort statutes that deals with the criteria for what lands a county may map as eligible for a destination resort. To refresh your memory, there's a two-step process for resorts. First, counties map what lands are eligible. Then there has to be an application for master plan approval. So this is dealing with the mapping aspect. And the amendments here do a number of things. The original concept in the bill was to pull most of these requirements out of statute and essentially tell the Land Conservation and Development Commission to go deal with this under statewide planning goal 8. Based on the work of the work group, it's the feeling of that group that you should leave certain of the statutory provisions in place in terms of what lands can be mapped as eligible for a destination resort. So that those provisions begin at the bottom of page 3 on line 28. And so the first one is the prohibition on a resort within 24 air miles of an urban growth boundary with a population of 100,000 or more. That's in existing law. So this is in putting back in place a limitation on mapping that's in existing law. So that would stay. And the second one is similarly putting back a provision that's in existing law, the prohibition on siting resorts within 3 miles of a high-value crop area. I think you heard in earlier testimony some concern about moving away from the high-value crop area provision in the resort law, so this would put it back in as it exists in current law. The next provision, paragraph C at the top of page 4, would prohibit siting resorts on a site within a district. These are the districts in ORS 540-505. That is an irrigation district. In particular, these are the large irrigation districts. So this is new. This is not in current law. This would add an additional screen, if you will, for siting of resorts to prevent their siting within an irrigation district. The next paragraph is also new. It deals with...
Excuse me, Mr.
Yes.
Whitman. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to... Can we ask a question or two as we're going through?
I think it's helpful as we go through so that we can understand it. And then we'll hear public testimony.
Okay. I'm wondering, Mr. Whitman, like on the irrigation district piece, would that have had an impact, for an example, at Running Y in Klamath Falls? Are they within the Klamath Irrigation District?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I just don't know whether Running Y is within an irrigation district or not.
Follow up?
You may follow up, but one thing I think we should clarify is that we're talking about large irrigation districts here, not there's a certain threshold, as the reference in here is a district as defined by ORS 540.505. Could you clarify what that division is or what cutoff is?
Madam Chair, there is no set size limit in that statute. It is simply as a matter of fact. It's the larger irrigation districts in the state that are organized under that particular chapter. There are a number of chapters that irrigation districts can be formed under. We didn't put them all in. It was, again, felt by the work group that this, because it is a factual matter, address the larger districts was appropriate.
And your follow-up?
Okay. My follow-up question, and maybe you can't answer this right now, but I think it would be important to answer. You know, as the mapping applies today to destination resort potential properties, which of those properties would be impacted by this? In my mind, and I'm just kind of thinking of an overlay, I'm thinking of places like, Brizada Ranch. Is that out in the irrigation district? I mean, somebody sitting here probably knows, but I'm thinking the Deschutes irrigation system runs over a huge portion of central Oregon. Would this have precluded how many destination resorts if this would have been in place?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it's a good question, and I know we have been working to get some information on exactly what districts are formed under this particular authority. Thank you. And so I do have a map here, which I have not seen before, so I hesitate to say anything in particular about it. But we will, Representative Hanna, we'll look into it and get you some information.
Thank you.
And
Representative Greenlick?
I'm a little confused about the whole process here, so should I wait till he's finished to ask why we're doing what we're doing and how it relates to what was done before? Or should I tee up the question so he can?
I think you've teed it up.
Well, the Shallon Mayor, the first order, I mean, this bill was put in by your department, and saying shall. And now, how does the task force relate to your department is the question. Who are they and why may rather than shall? So maybe we should wait.
Maybe we should wait on that one. That's a kind of overarching. Does someone else have a question? Mr. Representative Escobar.
Yeah, I was, and you'll answer this later because I think Representative Greenlick was getting there. I was curious on who they are, the work group, and so on and so forth because, I don't know anything about this group. The second thing is, explain to me what is in an area of especially sensitive big game habitat.
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, this is similar to but slightly different than current law. Current law provides that in an area of especially sensitive big game habitat, as mapped by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife in 1984 or as provided in an acknowledged county comprehensive plan. This would, if you will, generalize that standard so that it would not lead to an immediate change in the law because that the other provision would still exist in Goal 8. But longer term, as the Land Conservation and Development Commission does undertake a study of destination resorts, it would allow some variation, some flexibility in terms of how that particular criterion is applied in different areas of the state. That was the intent behind changing the wording. And also so that we're not locked into, if you will, a 1984 map done by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that may or may not have relevance today.
Yeah, I have a great concern with that section.
And just to answer the question, the group that was working on this bill were the members of this committee that expressed an interest in following through, which would include Representative Clem, Representative Garrett, and myself. And we consulted with a variety of interest groups who have testified and weighed in on this, and some of whom you'll hear from today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Whitman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the next provision deals with wildland fire risk. This is also new. So the provision would prohibit the siting of a destination resort on lands that are predominantly classified as being in fire regime condition class 3. I'm going to pause there. That is a federal That's a term of art under federal land management law. It's the highest class of wildland fire risk as measured by the U.S. Forest Service. We have looked at maps of what areas would be covered by this, and it varies around the state. If particular members have concerns, we can make those maps available to the committee for you to look at.
Just to be clear, when you say highest level, you mean most at risk.
Most at risk of...
Not the broadest coverage, but the actually almost the narrowest coverage.
Most at risk, and I believe the terminology is most at risk of a stand-replacing fire, a very intense fire that will essentially wipe out the existing forest vegetation.
Chair, while we're there...
Yes, Representative Hanna.
Thank you. Mr. Whitman, in the few hearings that we've had on this particular bill and during some of the testimony that we took when we were over in Central Oregon on this bill, the testimony has been given a few times now from, I think I'm characterizing this correctly, proponents of much stricter land use regulations. Regarding fire, I mean, that somehow destination resorts and fire, are there recorded cases of destination resorts causing fires?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it's not a matter necessarily of a destination resort causing fire. What we have been told in writing by the U.S. Forest Service is that when there is a resort put in place, the cost of managing fire around that resort, because of the necessity of protecting lives and structures, increases dramatically, number one. And then number two, we also have reports from the Oregon Department of Forestry, and I believe also from the Forest Service, showing that as you increase the density of structures and people in an area, the risk of fire goes up. So it's not in a strictly legal sense that the resort is causing those fires to occur, but it increases the cost of fighting them, and it increases the risk simply by introducing more people into an area.
Quick follow-up. I think it should be noted that private landowners currently pay somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% of all wildland fire costs. And so when you say that for the record, I think we ought to say for the record, private forest land fire protection is paid predominantly by private forest land owners. And that's an issue that we're going to deal with during the legislative process again. And so it's interesting to me that based on the testimony of risk rather than actual cause, because I'd probably go to the issue of catastrophic fire. If we looked at how they started, it'll be lightning caused. It'll be slash burn. I'm not aware of any single resort, and I hesitate to say it because you worry somebody would go out there and do it, but I'm not, you know, I don't know of any particular resort who has done it. In fact, I would say that a great deal of forest fire mitigation work has been done around those areas. So this new argument about fire is just perplexing to me to some degree.
Mr. Whitman?
Madam Chair, so...
Do you want to continue, or because I think Representative Clem had something on that same line, or did you want to respond?
No.
Representative Clem?
I just wanted to comment because today in House Ag, we heard the first portion of the firefighting program, the harvest tax, part of it goes there, and we're going to be hearing more. The private landowners have actually been paying more like 80% the last few years. So our goal for the session is to try and get that back down to 50-50. But I can certainly remember hearing about fires, and I don't remember what the name of the fire was, but I remember hearing Black Butte was potentially at risk a few years ago. There was some concern that one of the fires would would hit it. And so I think I would stipulate that I've never heard of anything being caused on site at all. I've never heard of that. But I do know that every home that is sited in forest land, it does get first priority in our firefighting program for life and structures. And so the more you build, that's where the protection has to be. And mostly lightning, I would guess, but someone has to go out and guard it. Landowners right now are paying roughly around 80% of guarding it. I'd like to get that back down to the 50-50, because in the surrounding states they pay zero, and ours do a heroic job of funding our firefighting program. But there's no doubt that it changes the priorities of where the firefighters goes if there's a structure of life involved. I think that's written right into the law.
Okay. Mr. Whitman.
Madam Chair, so recognizing there was some concern that putting this criterion in statute would take too much off the table, as you will, in terms of siting of resorts. So the second clause of this paragraph D does provide a safety valve, if you will. So if a county prepares a community wildfire protection plan that demonstrates the site can be developed without being at high overall risk. Again, these are terms of art, if you will, from federal land management under the Healthy Forest Initiative's communities. Counties are required to and already have prepared community wildfire protection plans. Under this, if a new resort goes in or is mapped for an area that's high fire risk, that could be done, but the county would need to amend its community wildfire protection plan to essentially provide for the management of the forest or the additional facilities necessary to reduce that from a high-risk category to a lower category of risk. So that's the safety valve, if you will, on the wildfire piece.
Okay.
The next paragraph, paragraph E, cubic foot site class 1 and 2 forest lands is existing law in terms of a criterion of lands where you can't map for a resort, as is paragraph F, the scenic area in the Columbia River Gorge. I already spoke of the especially sensitive big game habitat. Again, this would not lead to an immediate change in law, but it could lead to a change down the road if LCDC were to amend Goal 8. And then subsection 2 here is putting back in the statutory existing definition of high-value crop area. So that's the, if you will, the revised Section 5, the criteria for mapping of destination resorts.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winger.
Is it possible to get a map of the state with these rules that are being proposed here so that we have some sense as a committee of how much and to what extent we're blocking off area? Or maybe to reverse that question, so we have some sense of what is in the possible landmass for destination resort development?
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, I believe, so with regard to the new things that we would be proposing to put in law, I think for those things we can provide you with some mapping that will show you what those new things would entail in terms of the land area that's covered. In terms of the existing provisions of the destination resort law, I believe it's 8 counties have been through the mapping process, and it would be essentially impossible for us to get the information on the existing criteria. But if you're concerned about what additional lands we'd be taking off the table potentially as a result of this, I think we can get you some mapping that will give you an indication of that.
Follow up?
Yes, Representative.
Well, more as a statement, I guess. I just think that, this is important. This is significant language that you're proposing. This is a significant policy to set, and I think that I guess I can't imagine this committee voting on this bill without having a map in front of it so it has some understanding of the consequences or potential, whichever word you want to use, for this combined language 1 through 6 and what exactly it is that we're doing. I mean, to have sort of some vague idea. This doesn't seem to be enough information for a legislative committee to be basing a decision like this on.
Mr. Whitman?
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard. So the difficult one of the existing criteria are the lands that are classified, the lands that are within 3 miles of high-value cropland. That is a fairly, the analysis of what high-value cropland is a large part of the work that each county has to go through in the mapping process. So that's not something I can just, we can pull off the shelf and show you. We can show you, for instance, I know for Jefferson County, there are maps of high-value cropland within Jefferson County. I believe we can for some of the other counties that have mapped for destination resorts. So we can get you, we'll certainly try to get you as much mapping information as we can about all of these. I'm just cautioning that for some of this, it's a fairly time-intensive analysis, which is part of the reason I believe that you've only got 8 counties that have gone through the work to map areas as eligible for destination resorts under these provisions. Just as context for that, also remember that the destination resort statutes we're dealing with here essentially provide an expedited means of citing resorts. Resorts can still be cited under the regular land use process through an exceptions process, which is the way that they were done before we had a destination resort statute, and to this day can still be done that way and continue to be done that way. This is if you want an easier path to cite a destination resort, these are things that you've tests that you've got to get by.
And I think that's an important point for us to pay attention to. So it isn't a matter of taking lands off of the possibility of citing destination resorts. It's saying if you want to go through a streamlined, quicker approach, here are the criteria you need to meet in order to be eligible for that streamlined approach. You can still pursue the normal course, and nothing in this bill changes that.
Madam Chair, my only point was that I think that, you know, when you add things and you have a list, it's a good idea for us to have some idea of the impact.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate your willingness to give us some maps to the extent that that can be combined into one map so that you have some idea of what is possible. It's just very helpful for me. I don't know about other members of the committee, but it, you know, I mean, each of these individually, I have no idea whether it's 1 acre, 100 acres, or 100,000 acres, and so... to be able to see a map about sort of what we're putting off limits under this process would be very, very helpful.
Okay, let's see if
we'll
we can follow
best.
Up on that. Representative Clem.
I just thought it might be helpful for others to see something that I know I've seen in Prineville in October, because it would probably give you a pretty good before and after, and it's Klamath County. But I think you'd want to see it on its own, because literally like half their county is mapped. I mean, it's a lot, basically. And so to see how the bill would affect Klamath County would probably be helpful. Now, when they made this statute, I don't know if they got maps to say how much would be opened up all over Oregon if you do it, but I think it would be helpful to see both before and after maps. Mm-hmm. But that's a county where it would be probably the most stark if there's going to be one, just because they mapped, a lot.
Okay.
I don't know if they'll ever get built, but there's a lot mapped.
Mr. Whitman?
Madam Chair, the next set of changes are in a revised Section 6, which is ORS 197-460. These are criteria for, not for the mapping, but for the siting of destination resorts. So there are a number of editorial changes by Legislative Council here, but the main changes here are... Well, and you also received some testimony, I believe, from some folks working with destination resort industry that expressed some concerns about perhaps some unintended consequences of moving away from existing language in the bill. So we've generally gone back to existing language in the bill as much as possible here. So the changes to bring to your attention as being real substantive changes in subsection 3, starting on line 30 of page 4 and then going on to page 5. It changes the standard for, I'm sorry, this is a standard for effects on surrounding lands, particularly effects on farming operations in the area, from minimize to mitigate. That was felt to be a slightly higher standard, if you will, for addressing impacts on surrounding uses. And then the main change here is a new subsection 4, which adds three new requirements for the siting of destination resorts. The first of those is, and this starts on line 9, page 5.
Of the
Dash 5 amendment. And the first one is that a destination resort avoid or mitigate direct or indirect adverse effects on state highways, county roads, and city streets. This is intended to address the transportation impacts of destination resorts. Under current law, since destination resorts cited under this statutory process are not done as an amendment of a comprehensive plan, they do not have to address directly transportation impacts in the same way that things that require a comprehensive plan amendment normally have to. So this is put in recognizing that. The second provision is provide for adequate firefighting facilities and services. I want to make clear here, this does not necessarily require that those facilities and services be on the site of the resort. This is provide for as in work with an existing district or an existing service provider, or provide it on site. It's going to be up to the counties to decide what that means. And then similarly, the third requirement also is new, but also does not necessarily require housing on site for workers, but again, requires that there be some provision for workforce housing for individuals working at resorts. In, So the next change is, the next change would delete the section 11 as introduced in the bill and replace it with this new section 10. This is the section that deals with the applicability of these changes in the resort law. This is important. It would not affect current mapping of destination resorts that a county has. It would also not affect existing destination resorts. And it would not affect a developer who has an application filed for a destination resort before the effective date of this law. So it's prospective. Mm-hmm. It would apply to counties undertaking new mapping. It would apply to new siting of resorts.
I don't know if it'd be any different.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just to verify, this last section is identical to the Dash 1 amendments I brought, I believe?
It looked like it to me. I tried to read it letter for letter, but I can't swear to it, Representative Wingert, but it looked pretty close to me. Representative Hannah?
No, it isn't exactly. It isn't exactly right. The Section 10 part is not precisely the same.
Section 7 stays in.
No, the repeal of Section 7. Representative Hannah?
Yeah. On line 10 of page 5, adverse effects, can you give us a description? I mean, does that just mean increased traffic, or what does that mean?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, it would mean a negative effect on a state highway, a county road, or a city street. Again, this is worded in a fairly open-ended manner that would provide a certain amount of discretion at the county level for how this is applied when a county is making a decision on whether to approve a resort.
Follow-up? But to the point that... Help me with a description of an adverse effect on a state highway.
All right.
Hold on,
So during this past summer, when there was a hearing in Prineville of the Interim Committee on Ag and Natural Resources, along with the Land Conservation and Development Commission, we heard testimony about resorts that were sited and approved in Crook County, and I'm not going to pick on any particular resort, but resorts that were approved in one county, fairly near a county line, where there are increases in traffic as a result of that resort that affect roadways in another jurisdiction, not within the jurisdiction of the county. And so this bill is intended to provide that a county is going to have to consider those impacts really regardless of the jurisdiction that they occur in.
Thank you. Just as a follow-up, Madam Chair, I mean, what that sounds like to me is that it is so broad. I mean, basically we're saying adverse effects, and that could mean as little as, simply put, increased traffic. I mean, I know this is going to sound silly, but what crossed my mind is pretty soon, what are we going to say? Let's not have a holiday because it's going to have an adverse effect on the state highways. We're going to have increased traffic. Let's not have a U of O football game because it's going to have an adverse effect on state highways.
You might get a few
highway.
Votes for that one, Representative.
So, I mean, I think that's just so broad as to almost be not possible. I mean, unless you want to just say we don't ever want to have increased visitation to our state, or we don't ever expect growth. If all we're saying is increased traffic is adverse effect, by that one rule alone, you could say no to every destination resort.
But the county's ability to mitigate a single car traveling to a destination doesn't require any action at all. Sorry. But if it's 10,000 cars going across a two-lane road that was built to handle farm equipment, particularly, as Mr. Whitman points out, if it is an adjacent county that does not participate in the decision, what this says is the county making the decision has to take into account that it's not dumping a burden onto its neighbors.
But, Madam Chair, I'd go right back to any kind of a statewide event. I mean, if the new Major League Soccer team draws hundreds of thousands of fans and they leave Jackson County and drive up I-5, we didn't approve that event in Douglas County, nor did Lane County, nor did Linn County, nor did every other county on the way there. But we live in Oregon. We're all Oregonians.
Right. So,
And represent.
We'll make sure they do.
By my.
Representative Klein. And then I'm going to go to public testimony because I've got several folks who've waited to listen
testify. I just want to have everyone understand because this stuff is kind of arcane. But the term avoid or minimize adverse effects, and here we're saying mitigate, which is another option, it's already in the statute, and it relates to intensive farming operations. So we have the three-mile crop area. Then we have something saying you basically can't do it if you have you haven't avoided or had a minimal adverse effect. And the whole reason we're here is because farmers are saying this language is so weak, it allows you to put a destination resort right across the street from my farm. So most people think that this language is a joke in terms of actually protecting the farming portion. So at some point we'll have to probably have a lawyer explain what we're talking about, but I just wanted, no one would know this unless you're a land use lawyer. And only because I've been studying this now for so long, the ability to mitigate against the failed intersection at Tumalo would be a requirement now under this bill. That was one brought up in Prineville. They said there's a failed intersection, had nothing to do with the destination resort. It's been declared failed for quite some time or something by the transportation department. And when you added in two new resorts and they're all going right through that same intersection, we would like to have some tool to have the additional traffic either mitigated or avoided. But it's not happy with the farming community. This language, they would want it much tighter for farming. And so I think understanding what these terms really end up meaning is important, because it sounds on its face like you're right, you couldn't do anything. But I don't think that's probably the case in reality, because the existing statute is uses the same words.
Okay, I'm going to go to public testimony so we have an opportunity to give people who made an attempt to come here and talk give us the benefit of their points of view. I've got 8 folks up to testify, so I'm going to set a 3-minute limit on testimony. Let's bring Matt Cyrus, Peter Livingston, and Kate Kimball to the diet, to the witness table. Mr. Cyrus, 3 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Nolan, members of the committee. My name is Matt Cyrus. I'm from reside in Deschutes County. I want to clarify the fact that I'm a sixth-generation farmer in Deschutes County, and so I can speak to the ag, the farmers in our area, and also have a background in 27 years in the fire department, and we contract with the Forest Service and have actually run dozers on all of the fires that have occurred in the Sisters area in the last 15 or 20 years, so I can also speak to some of the wildfire issues. First thing I'd like to do is address the report that you received at the last hearing, the economic report or the study that was presented. Want to point out a couple things with it quickly. First of all, there hasn't been an opportunity for peer review to take a good hard look at the facts and figures and numbers that were cited in this report. A couple of the obvious errors in this report, for example, one of the baselines it used was an assumption of a $16,000 annual income for resort employees, when in fact the Oregon Department of Employment study published in 2007 using 2005 data indicates the average resort salaries are actually $26,000, not the $16,000 that was stated in the report. It also assumes new residents for employment moving into the area that would be employed at the resorts rather than any of the 12% unemployment that we currently have. It discounts completely the use of multipliers, which goes back to Economics 101 as a standard baseline in economics. The report compares the Thornburg to the Eagle Crest Resort instead of more comparable type resorts with similar proposed values and amenities such as Tethero or Caldera. It assumes a theoretical number of 500 students from this resort, generated by this resort, instead of using numbers more comparable to the actual counts that were determined by Eagle Crest in 2005 of 17 students. They were assuming over 500 students. So some of the impacts, like I say, the assumptions are maybe a little off base. In looking at the proposed amendments, the Dash 5, I think, is a start in the right direction. However, I would certainly not include irrigation districts as part of the high-value crop area. The high-value crop area designation is an OSU Extension Service definition put in place to protect high-concentration, high-intensity type operations such as field crops, berries, fruits, dairies, those type of things. Was never intended to protect pastures, grain crops, those type of things, which irrigation districts would cover, even non-farmland.
Can you wrap up, Mr. Cyrus?
Certainly. In closing, I would just say that by including irrigation districts in the high-value crop definition, you would include most of Deschutes County, whereas the current definition has identified no high-value crop area appropriately designated in our county.
Thank you. Mr. Livingston.
You don't want to go across? I'm sorry.
You're number 2 on the list.
I was relaxed.
I see.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to say that I have prepared another amendment which would...
Start with your name, please, and
thank
if
you,
you're
Peter
representing
Livingston.
An organization, state that, or if you just are here on your own behalf, your county of residence.
I'm here representing 2 clients.
Okay.
And my county of residence is Multnomah County. Now may I begin?
Yep. Yes.
Thank you. As I said, I have prepared a drafted amendment, which is going to be presented by Representative Esquivel when it's out, when it's been produced. And effectively what that does is to establish a study committee comprised of the various concerned parties, the state agencies, a county representative from each of the counties in the, around the state that's likely to have a destination resort, and one of the representative of the developers and one from the planners, effectively. And the reason is what triggered this is reviewing the economic study that was provided at the last hearing. I represented the Thornburg Resort, and so I'm familiar with the economic study that was done for that project and with the kinds of considerations that were a factor in preparing that report. And in my view, the study that was submitted last week is filled with inaccuracies, false assumptions, and for that reason, I hope it does not become the basis for any kind of policy decision making. I do want to say how much I appreciate these amendments that were submitted today. These address most of my specific concerns as expressed in a letter last week. But I wanted to join with Representative Hanna in adding to that list of concerns the language concerning state highways, county roads, and city streets, only because this is an extremely contentious issue at every destination resort hearing. And if you have language that's this demanding, it will be virtually impossible for someone to make the necessary demonstration that the standard is met. This is not a standard which is, you know, a broad one that allows infilling by DLCD. It's a standard that it's going to be in the statutes. It's going to be very strict and very, very difficult to meet. There's no limit on how far the roads, you know, what the radius you have to consider. So someone can say there will be 20 additional cars at some point 30 miles away at a failing intersection, and if you put this resort on, it's going to add 3 cars to that intersection, and it's going to get worse, and you have to mitigate. In my experience, resorts have been contributing, certainly lately, more than their fair share in terms of financial contributions to mitigate for impacts on state highways. And so this is something the committee needs to be very concerned with. I just wanted to renew a concern I expressed last time about small resorts, and obviously that's something you've considered, but it's not changed in this amendment, and it's not clear whether that means small resorts are going to be eliminated or if they're going to be included in some manner in the rules. So that's a concern for us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, offer questions for the whole panel. Okay. Yes. Ms. Kimball.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kate Kimball, and I'm here representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I want to thank the committee for taking on this issue. I know you have a lot on your plate, and I appreciate that you've made this a priority. Last time I was here, I had a long list of things that we wanted changed in the bill, and most of them didn't happen. But we think this is a step in the right direction. As Mr. Livingston said, there are some things here that really are moving us along. I want to talk briefly about three issues. One, on the fire issue, the way I read the language, resorts can still be sited in the highest fire risk area if proper planning is done. And, of course, as planning advocates, we like proper planning. Secondly, as to the irrigation districts, irrigation districts are places where commercial farming happens, and to say to put a resort in an irrigation district obviously displaces farming, and we would have a concern with that because we want to protect our commercial farmlands. On the third point about transportation and the obligation to avoid or mitigate adverse transportation effects, it seems to me that the obligation to do that, to avoid or mitigate, is limited by the area of impact, that it isn't limitless. It just says when you have an impact, you need to do something to take care of that so that resorts aren't, in essence, imposing an impact on the community, and the community has no way to address that. I think you've heard testimony from Redmond about some of the transportation impacts Redmond has felt from resorts, and all I see is this says that the resort should work with the communities to make sure that they aren't imposing additional traffic impacts that aren't avoided or mitigated. In general, though, thank you for the work, and we are pleased with these amendments.
Good. Thank you. Now, questions for this panel? Representative Garrett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Peter, this is a question for you, and it also follows on Representative Hanna's question. I don't know how the word mitigate has been interpreted in any case law, in land use, but it doesn't mean there can't be any impact. It means lessen or reduce. And so my question is, if that language doesn't work, telling them that you've got to basically deal with it, what language ought we use to make sure that the transportation burdens are accounted for?
I'd be happy to come up with some a little later. It's hard for me to do that on the spot.
Yeah,
but my concern is not with the avoid or mitigate language, but with direct and indirect adverse effects on state highways, county roads, and city streets. There's no limitation on distance. So one of the challenges you face if you're the applicant is trying to figure out how to meet the standard. And one of the issues with highways and transportation issues in general is that there's always a traffic engineer willing to come in and say whatever. So you can't. The way it works in practice is that people go out, you know, they try to identify the significant intersections surrounding the resort or road conditions on a county road that might be rough, that need repair, et cetera. You do your best to figure that out and then address those issues. But there's always going to be a complaint. Well, you didn't get out far enough, and you didn't, you haven't met the standard, because the standard says on state highways, county roads, and city streets. It doesn't say where they are. And so you get to Representative Hannah's question, which is, if you have five new cars on a failing intersection some distance away, is that the responsibility of the resort? Part of the problem in general is that there is no mechanism right now to have someone make improvements to a road and then seek reimbursement from subsequent development. So you end up with a very expensive prospect in the short term, which is very difficult for resorts. And for that reason, I just asked the committee, and I'd be happy to suggest, to work really hard on making this a burden that is easily defined, easily perceived by all parties, and easily addressed. It isn't so much a matter of putting a dollar limit on it, it's just knowing when you've done enough in terms of presenting any idea.
Therein is the art, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, anybody else? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, in these particular resorts, I should have asked this prior to this. Do we not do traffic studies on these?
Yes, Representative. Typically, in my experience, the county has had standards that have had to be met, and sometimes they're more clear than others. But the truth is that you can't get an approved resort if you haven't addressed reasonable impacts on county roads, et cetera, whether they're in the code or not. But the traffic studies typically are focused on state highway facilities, and often, there will be, and it's sort of by discussion with ODOT, which facilities are likely to be involved and how are they going to be affected, and then everyone sort of scopes them out. At that point, there's a study done, and it's determined that within a 20-year time period, there will be a failing intersection as a result of the resort. So it gets complicated quickly, but yes, there is always a study.
Yes would have been fine, sir. The second thing is, if you have some sort of an effect on an intersection that's down the road here, do you not have to perform off-site improvements in order to get approval for the resort itself?
In my experience, yes.
Okay.
Ms. Kimball, would you like to respond?
In my experience, so far the traffic impacts of resorts have been pretty much reduced to adding a turn lane at the resort, and they have not done much in the way of off-site improvements except where they're very dramatic, say in the Tumalo situation. But I would say that transportation impacts have not been fully mitigated, and as I alluded to earlier, I think Redmond has details on how Redmond has had to essentially subsidize the traffic impacts from nearby resorts.
Thanks. Thank you. Let's bring up Sean Jillians, Linda Ludwig, and Jonathan Manton. Mr. Jillians, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I apologize, Madam Chair. I just got the dash fives here in the room, and I'm trying to read through the bill and the amendments. But I did have a couple comments and reiterate the comments that we made in the original hearing on the bill, in that we are concerned about all of the statutory requirements and parameters for destination resorts coming out and going into the rulemaking process with no guidance from the legislature. That seems to remain in the dash five. As to the new language, subsection D, which is on page 2, what is that? Section 2-1 or 2-2D allows for LCDC to make a determination that destination resorts should be capped regionally or by county. I think that's very concerning from our part, what the definition of a region is and whether or not they might just determine Central Oregon has enough destination resorts, period, and none of the counties have any say in that will be problematic from our perspective. I would jump on the bandwagon of the complaint about the avoid or mitigate, and I do understand, Representative Clem, your concern with the farming and the direct impacts. I think this language does not talk about direct impacts at all. The indirect effects of transportation is extremely broad, and while I am a member of the real estate and land use section of the bar, I don't pretend to be an actual practicing land use attorney. I can tell you that that is a high standard, though. For all the committee members. The last provision as well, I certainly understand the desire to provide for workforce housing for communities. I don't know that we have a lot of other provisions, though, that we require every business in the state of Oregon, and this says the county shall require that they deal with workforce housing. I think that would be a difficult threshold also. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Ludwig?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I haven't testified on the bill before, and my portion of this in terms of testimony is very small, although I want to let Representative Wingard know that I love the Dash 1 amendment. Really, our interest is in terms of the impacts to transportation, in terms of other jurisdictions, adjoining counties, particularly cities across the way. The current Goal 8 language that guides this process has no entryway, makes no statement about adverse effects on state highways, county roads, or city streets. So cities that are near resorts have no entree into the county process currently. So we believe the language in the Dash 5 and the base language in the bill dealing with mitigation of direct or indirect impacts to city streets is very, very important. I'm sure in Central Oregon the committee heard from the city of Redmond, potentially city of Madras, city of Sisters. We hear from the Central Oregon Cities Organization to a large extent. I would make the suggestion, particularly if you aren't settled on the language currently in the Dash 5, in on page 5, on lines 10 and 11, perhaps the addition of the word avoid or mitigate significant direct or indirect adverse effects on state highways, county roads, city streets might be helpful. We believe that it softens that standard somewhat, but still would allow the entree into the county process. Very important for cities. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Manton.
Members of the committee and Chair Nolan, my name is Jonathan Manton. I'm representing Central Oregon Land Watch. And Eric Kanzler, who's the executive director of Central Oregon Land Watch, had submitted some electronic and written testimony earlier, so I won't go through that. But while we're on the conversation of this standard, I want to just draw the attention of the committee to two court cases. One is LUBA decision Gould versus Deschutes County. And in that instance, LUBA interpreted the minimize standard to allow the development to go forward simply if some mitigation measures are done. And so, again, it's just kind of showing that that's not a very strong standard. The second case is an Oregon Supreme Court case, Friends of Parrot Mountain versus Northwest Natural, and they interpreted to minimize as essentially meaning only reducing impacts to the extent possible, but not avoiding or eliminating impacts. So virtually anything can be done to reduce impacts. But ultimately, the resource is not going to be protected with that standard. And so that's why we're in support of the mitigate standard instead of just the minimize. And couple other just quick things that we're asking the committee to consider, and that would be the need for county-level enforcement mechanisms on these changes. So if you're going to have the ratio that's in place now with residential units to overnight units, there's not really much to enforce a developer to comply with that. And then also hope that the committee would consider requiring fiscal and economic analysis of impacts as a condition of county approval. And so as we're talking about kind of like that streamlined approach, perhaps that could be something that's added there. And Eben Fodor, who conducted the study that's been talked about, is here, the impact study. And so I'll let him. He's going to come next. I think he can maybe address some of the concerns that has been expressed about the study. Thank you.
Thanks. Questions, and then we'll see. Questions for the panel? Representative Garrett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, I could ask you just to repeat that you cited a case, and I think you quoted an interpretation of the word minimize that meant, the court said, meant to mitigate. Is that what I heard?
No, I'm sorry, and that's I probably just expressed that incorrectly. It's the court case is Friends of Parrot Mountain versus Northwest Natural. That's the Supreme Court case.
I was thinking of the Gould case, the one you mentioned first.
That is... Right, I'm drawing from an analysis here by Paul Dewey, which is also in some of the testimony that's been submitted earlier. He is a land use attorney in Central Oregon. And he says, quote, talking about the standard, this has been interpreted by Luba and Gould to allow the development to go forward simply if some mitigation measures are done.
And that's the interpretation of the minimize standard?
That's correct.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, if I may, as I read this, the use of the word mitigate means some mitigation must occur. And I'm not sure if we're actually elevating the standard in this bill beyond what is currently contained in law. I wouldn't support a bill that I thought was going to not allow for any even de minimis adverse impact on roads, but I don't think that's what we're doing here. So, just for the record.
And may I respond to that just real quick?
No. Sure.
Representative Garrett, I think that this, as I read this decision, this statement, it's essentially saying that the standard now is de minimis, that minimize has essentially been interpreted as a de minimis impact that you have to, quote, mitigate. And the mitigate standard would be much stronger.
You wanted to respond, Mr. Jillians.
If I could just real quick, Madam Chair, on that point as well. I think adding the word avoid before mitigate does do that, and also talking about indirect rather than direct. So I think it does actually expand by quite a bit. That the last point I wanted to make, and I apologize for not making it, Madam Chair, if there is another informal work group, I would certainly be happy to participate in that.
Thanks. Okay, Representative Wingert?
I want to stay on this for a second. I'm still trying to figure out what a significant indirect adverse effect would be. getting to what Representative Hanna originally said that I've been tuned on now for a while, it seems to me that we're kind of debating two elements of the traffic impact that a development has. One is its direct impact on how it connects to the system, and you might have an entrance or an exit, and people, a noticeable number of people trying to get there, and therefore you're expecting, there's some assumption, I assume, in policy that you want the developer to help to widen the road or do what's necessary to make that intersection or roadway still function so that people can get in and out without it creating some kind of a log jam. But when we start talking about the idea that some destination resort or any development might have an impact on city streets somewhere down the way, I think what you're really talking about is the fact that you wanted the development to bring people in for the economic activity, and then they're there doing that economic activity, meaning they're driving on your city roads, and now you want the development to compensate you for what you asked for, which essentially was the economic activity. And I think there's a difference between... and I'm not sure if I'm using these words in the legal way they're meant to be used, but the direct impact that your development has on how it connects into the transportation system, and just basically saying, well, you're going to bring hundreds of people to our city, or you're going to bring them nearby our city, so we want you to repave our streets and do all the things. But they're not getting compensated for the economic activity that they brought into your city, which you certainly enjoy, or county, or whatever. So I just see a real difference, and I think that you really are placing one heck of a burden on any developer by asking them to take into effect the economic, the impact, the traffic impact of the economic activity that they bring into the region. And so that is really troubling to me. End of speech.
Okay, thanks. Representative Esquivel?
Just one real quick thing. What,
is there a question
I,
of the panel, or because we can have time later for discussion?
Well, I'm going to ask the panel, but I'm not sure they could answer this. Are we not maybe creating a one-trip threshold? Don't everyone answer at once.
I'll answer. No, we're not.
I'm not sure of that.
Then we'll find a better question.
I'll jump up, Madam Chair. I think you could.
That's what I think.
I don't think so.
I think an indirect adverse mm-hmm. effect on a city street could be one visitor going through. And it would definitely be on one if you could connect the dots to Portland out to Central Oregon of people traveling out there.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
I don't think so.
We did that by mistake in Medford, similar language. That's what just... I just remembered that, and it was out on Delta Waters down there in that project.
Okay.
Yeah. We had to rescind
it.
Just to continue kicking a horse which is clearly dead. But I just looked up mitigate. To lessen in force or intensity, to moderate, to make milder or more gentle, mollify, or appease. As I read this language, it says avoid these effects, or if you can't, mitigate. And I'm very sensitive to this, the point that we're making this, that we are creating an unreasonable and insurmountable burden, and I don't think anybody here wants to do that. But maybe we need to continue looking at it, but I just don't think this language, you can't stop lawyers from making arguments, but I don't think this language creates the burden that you're concerned with. Although
there
I
is some language you could probably you could almost yeah. certainly get a lot of support for.
Right.
Lawyers will not make arguments.
I apparently am done with that comment. I would just on that topic, and I promise I'll shut up as well. I think it's not necessarily even that it's the developer who's going to have to pay for this indirect impact somewhere down the road. It's someone challenging the resort and saying the county did not take this into account. So-and-so who drove over the bridge down there, that had an impact, and so you cannot go forward with your project. That's the concern that I would see would be the biggest one. And it would be lawyers arguing, and that's the concern.
Always a concern. Yes.
Okay. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wondered if we could give Ms. Ludwig a moment to expand a little bit on the impact to cities when you have transportation moving through a city to a new area. I was interested in Representative Wingard's comments about asking for the development and the revenue that's seen, but that's not a revenue stream that goes back into local government that allows for the transportation infrastructure that's needed. So I was hoping we could allow you just a little more time to expand on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cowan, I'm truly not the expert, and I wish that I had a Central Oregon cohort with me to talk about specifics. But what I would say is, in terms of the county, when looking at a destination resort mapping or application, the cities would very much like them to have direction, which is currently not in Goal 8, to look at and be aware of the potential impacts that traffic has through their cities, such as the City of Sisters, there where we have a very limited roadway. And frankly, destination resorts, even a distance from that city traveling through, does have some impacts. Maybe they wouldn't be direct financial impacts asked by the developer to mitigate those, but certainly some of those roads in existing cities may be at capacity currently, and those extra trip generations may put them over capacity, or potentially they're in a situation where they may not be allowed additional development along that street because they're already at capacity or tipped over the balance. And while that may not be a consideration that the county would provide any resources, direct resources for, to have that entree into the process certainly would enlighten the Department of Transportation when looking at other provisions of the TPR and implementing them directly for that city. So there's a host of connectors there that interface is important to for cities.
Follow-up,
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the point I'm simply trying to make is that any wonderful new revenue streams that come into businesses in a community as a result of a destination resort don't fall directly to the local government that has to support the infrastructure to allow that to happen. And that's simply the follow-up I was trying to make.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winger.
I just want to make sure I heard what Linda was saying, because I think it kind of goes to the point I was making. So somebody wants to develop a destination resort out in Bend, and most of those people, or at least it's determined that a lot of those people are going to come to Bend across the highway through Sisters. And Sisters is going to have some right of entry into this process, even though they may be 50 miles or more away from the destination resort, because they have a highway that may be at capacity on which people are going to be traveling there. I guess that was sort of the concern that I heard raised that I'm now beginning to share, that if you don't put some boundaries around what it means to have impact, ultimately anybody getting in their car and driving anywhere else in this state to arrive at some destination is having an indirect adverse effect on the roads and streets that they cross along that journey. And I guess I would be very concerned if anything in this bill allowed the City of Sisters to insert itself in a destination resort plan that was going on 50 miles away, because some share of those people are going to be driving through Sisters to get out there. I think you've opened it up to the point where everybody's in the conversation then, and it's a committee of $3.5 million deciding on the future of the resort.
Madam Chair, Representative Winger, my last and only comment of enlightenment for the committee is that this standard for the destination resorts for the county to take into consideration would just put them on par with every single other type of comprehensive plan amendment, what it does in terms of looking at the transportation impacts. No more, no greater, just the same standard that any other comp plan amendment for any other development application has to meet in terms of our process in the state.
Thanks. Okay. I have another panel to get to, okay, but go ahead, Representative.
Well, this is brief. I mean, that comment, should I understand then if I'm developing an industrial site in Deschutes County, inside the urban growth boundary of Bend, that they come and talk to the City of Sisters on the transportation plan?
Currently? Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I think that would be potentially in Bend, where you are an MPO, yes, that may occur within MPOs currently. So,
could you follow up to the committee with that exact ruling or method? So I'd like to understand that better, because I don't believe that's the case. So I'd just further follow up is fine.
Could we educate Representative Hanna offline?
Yeah.
Good. Thanks. Okay. Thank you. Eben Fodor, Brock Howell, Nunzi Gould, and then I have one other person, Linda Swearingen, and that's the entire list of people I've got signed up, unless there are others.
All right.
Mr. Fodor?
Hi there. Good afternoon. I'm Evan Fodor, Fodor & Associates, and the primary author of the study, Fiscal and Economic Impacts of destination resorts in Oregon, which was commissioned by Central Oregon Land Watch, and I think you all got a copy of it 2 weeks ago. So really, I'm just here to answer any questions you might have about it, if you had a chance to look at it, and respond to some of the comments that have been made here. You know, in doing this study, our goal was to really illuminate a topic that I think needs a lot more information. And that's one of the things that I believe the bill is proposing to do that you're considering is provide more information to evaluate the impacts of destination resorts a little further. We did a literature review as part of this project. We found no studies on the impacts of destination resorts other than those that had been prepared by the resort developers. So there isn't a lot of information out here. This study represents really the first effort to provide a broader, a more comprehensive, more accurate indication of the impacts that destination resorts are likely to have. They're often portrayed as being a rather large tax windfall for communities. And we looked at the tax revenues. We looked at the room property tax revenues, room tax revenues, and we looked at the infrastructure costs. And we found that overall there's a significant net cost associated with resort development to the public sector. So fiscal impacts or taxpayer impacts. In the resort we looked at, which is fairly typical, the proposed Thornburg Resort, we found a net cost of $46 million, which was much larger than I personally thought it would be. It's based on the best information available to us. Everything in this study is the most recent, best available information we could find. All the sources are cited and footnoted in the study. The analysis methodology is explicit in the study. So I would ask that, you know, people who want to criticize, it's very easy to criticize something, and I understand that there are probably lots of people out here who don't like the findings in the study and want to criticize it, that you hold them to a certain standard in doing so and ask them to provide the sources for their data. And if they've done some analysis, to show that analysis. And I think this is certainly not the final word on it. I hope there's lots more information that's forthcoming, and perhaps the resort community will, the development community will provide some of that information. And I just ask that you try to insist that it be of a certain quality rather than just simply issuing negative statements about a report. So if there are any questions, I'd be delighted to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Howell.
Thank you, Chair Nolan and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell, and I am the Transportation Land Use Advocate for Environment Oregon. We have 30,000 members across the state, and we work to protect clean air, clean water, and open space. And I've already testified on this once before, and the previous frame that I started with was why we have destination resorts. Of the two reasons, one, for the opportunity for people, visitors, to connect with nature, and the second, to provide an economic boon towards cities. And we think the -5 amendments are a very good step in that direction. It's not everything that I had listed on my thing, including ensuring protecting special places such as wild and scenic rivers, wildernesses, and make site distances from those locations, making sure we adjust for or mitigate our impact on global warming. But we think that these steps that are included in here are a very good step in the right direction. There have been a couple of issues brought up. One is with the transportation impact. As somebody who has practiced in the state to the north of us, would encourage you not to use their language with regard to this, which is concurrency. And so I believe this language, which is avoid or mitigate, is much more clear as to what that means and should at least be of more use to attorneys and planners in this field. And it's also important to note that the county does have, is afforded some discretion in this decision, and so it's not going to be an absolute. One thing of how transportation impacts is usually looked at is the potential of congestion on the roads, and so if there's no increase in delays caused by more traffic, usually it's considered a no net impact towards the road. So I think certainly the one more trip situation is not going to be the barrier to destination resorts. And finally, I'd like to mention there was some discussion about the Section 10 amendment, which is substantially similar to the Dash 1 Section 10 amendment, I think. And in fact, I think it might be a little bit stronger. I don't know if stronger is the right word, but includes more sections with essentially the same language. So with that, I yield my time. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Gould.
Hello, my name is Nunzi Gould. I live in Deschutes County. I'd like to start out by saying that I've been involved in quite detail on the Thornburg Resort, and it is still in the appeal stages both on the conceptual master plan and on the final master plan. And one thing that I don't know if your committee is aware is that resorts have presented themselves to counties in a very boilerplate format. They underestimate, underreport, and therefore are not really giving the full picture. Counties, on the other hand, are supposed to be representing the public, to be scrutinizing the data, and that really is not happening to the degree that it should be. To the tune that on the Thornburg Resort, you heard their attorney, Mr. Livingston, in previous testimony, he identified that there were no geographic features on the project when, in fact, it straddles Klein Buttes. Resorts are being projected as boilerplate projects. As such, I think it's very important that this new legislation discuss areas of population, not strictly the 100,000 for one UGB. Ben Redman and Sisters are an area within Central Oregon. The impact of locating a resort within a triangle of those cities is devastating to all of those cities. It impacts the roadways for all of those cities. Regarding fire, Cache Mountain fire, B&B complex fire caused evacuation of Black Butte. It is imperative that we locate human populations with the best protections and therefore keep them out of high-risk fire areas. Regarding Deschutes County Destination Resort map, you may not be aware that the actual map itself does not meet your state guidelines. It includes high prime farm soils, such as Type 65A, and it includes destination overlay closer than your three-mile limit. So I think it's very important that you evaluate what it is you're trying to achieve. Do not leave this process to each county. They need your guidance. They need statewide review. I have two other quick points. Resorts do not contribute their fair share towards transportation. If they had, Eagle Crest Resort would have actually paid the $240,000 towards a Tumalo intersection improvement. Those funds were identified by ODOT to be needed in 2005. ODOT now is projecting that maybe something might possibly in future be built in 2013. The funds have not been paid. The infrastructure is at a failing level, and our community is suffering. And if you come to Tumalo, please drive carefully. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Winger.
Ms. Cool, do you own property around a resort community?
I do. I own a lot at Pronghorn. I bought it as a spec investment. My husband and I are builders, and I do not live there. I live in Deschutes County, and I have since come way up the learning curve on the impacts of destination resorts, and I've since come way up the learning curve on what speculative land investments can leave you in this current economic crisis. And I participate in this process because many people, many, many people have created a market that I don't believe is sustainable. And I think it's a bad course for Oregon to continue on. And whether it's in my neck of the woods, in my viewshed, or anybody else's viewshed, it behooves this beautiful state to take an intelligent, educated, non-rushed view to protect her resources. And the Big Look really deserves this. And to just let local communities go for the bang for the buck, I do not think is the best way for Oregon to be going. I would much rather see development in UGBs, and as a builder, I have several projects, one in Redmond, one in Sisters, two in Bend. I would much rather see that concentrated development within UGBs and not, it's like scattering a bunch of marbles, and not just ruining your countryside.
Thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else for this panel? Representative Hannah.
Thank you. You mentioned the differences between what people thought of your report and others, and the only testimony I think we heard today where there was a point of difference was on the income. And I think the person who testified earlier cited the employment department at a level about $10,000 higher than what you cited. Can you?
I think that they...
You have the mic, please.
They may have miscited the report. The data that they referred to was basically taken out of the resort applicant's own economic study. So in using that data, basically I was presenting the data that they had in their study. So if they're finding that resorts pay higher than the own applicant reported, that may well be. The other study that, or the other piece of information that we reported was the average salary for the leisure and hospitality sector, which the resort is part of that sector. So we reported it as the average salary for the leisure and hospitality sector. We did not report it as the average salary for resorts. In all likelihood, resorts are going to be at the higher end of that sector. Nonetheless, it is a very low-wage sector, and it's quite possible that you could have not just one but two people in a household working at a resort and still have the overall impact of lowering the average household income, in this case, in Deschutes County.
Representative?
Well, Madam Chair, if we could, I'd like to stick to the point when we do the question, but that's your business. I think the person who testified cited the employment department for their number, but maybe I'll have to run back and see what the tape says. But okay. I think that's what they cited was not a report done by another resort or developer. I think they cited the employment department as where that number came from.
Right, but Mr. Fodor was taking his data off of the report resort application.
Right. We also used Oregon employment data, and there's the study for Central Oregon, Economic Development Central Oregon, that looked at the average wages from the leisure and hospitality sector in Central Oregon.
Linda Swearingen. Anyone else to testify on this bill? Ms. Swearingen, thank you for your patience.
My name is Linda Swearingen, for the record, and I reside in Redmond, Oregon. And I've had the pleasure of representing several different destination resorts over the years. And as I mentioned before, I've been the mayor of Sisters and a Deschutes County commissioner. And I'd like to just clarify how transportation figures are addressed, because there's been you've heard a lot of people say, well, cities aren't notified. Well, I know for a fact that that's not true, and I'd like to just cite some examples. In the case of Remington Ranch, which is a Crook County resort, they agreed to pay the city of Redmond a certain amount of money to address one of their failing intersections near the airport. They're in Redmond is in Deschutes County, and Remington is in Crook County. So that's already been addressed. In the case of Crescent Creek Resort, which is a Klamath County resort, they were also required to make some improvements in the city of Lapine. So to say that cities aren't included in this process is not correct. The cities may not agree that they're going, that the county is going to give them exactly what they want, but they are involved in the process, and money has been dedicated or agreed to be spent in the case of areas that needed to be mitigated. The way you determine what your impacts are going to be, the very first thing you do is you bring in a copy of the size and the scope of your resort, and you take it to a traffic engineer, and they begin to look at it. The next step is it goes directly to ODOT and the county, and they look at it, and they develop a scope. And sometimes what they do is they'll say, well, your impact is as many as 30 miles away, or it may be only 5 miles away. Then what they'll do is they'll look at all the impacted intersections, and those are based on, is, do you have a public golf course? Do you have a private golf course? How many homes do you have? Which county roads are you looking at? And they will actually look at turning movements on each of these intersections that are involved. And at that point, then what they'll do is they'll say, well, you throw this, this one's already failing, so you throw it over, or this one puts a large capacity on. So then what they'll do is, after they determine what the impact is, they will then say, we believe that you need to pay a proportionate share of your impact on this intersection, on this county highway, this city street, this intersection over here. And then that is taken to the county. It's brought before either your hearings officer, your planning commission, or your county commission. Then it can go on, all the way on up to the Supreme Court, and then they will determine exactly what your proportionate share will be. In the case of Hidden Canyon, a Crook County project, they've agreed to spend millions of dollars on an intersection that's already failing. As soon as they hit the, I believe it's like the 210th home, they have to take care of that intersection before they can have any more permits issued. And in the case of Eagle Crest, they were required to build an intersection. It's not just turning lanes. There is a process in place right now, and I would encourage you to bring in Bob Bryant from ODOT, from our local region, to talk to him about how that transportation process works. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Swearingen? Thank you for that information. Okay. I'm not planning to open a work session today. So I will close the public hearing. We've posted this bill for work session for Thursday. If we've got three amendments before the committee now, if any committee members want to consult with me on those bill, those amendments, or how we might move forward, please.
Will be bringing an amendment.
Okay, the sooner we have it, the more likely it is.
So we can get it, Madam Chair, we'll have it here.
And that would include full analysis of it if you can. But I'm hoping we can move this bill on Thursday, so please let me know what you're bringing forward and how we might work it together. We're adjourned.